Health, Wealth, and Divine. My name is Jawanza. Hope everybody's doing well. You know, I am just excited. Again, every time I have an opportunity to talk to people that have a lot to share. You know, you spend your days going through life, oftentimes talking. You know, we do a lot of talking in our life, and we actually do a lot of listening. And there's nothing that I enjoy more than talking and listening to people that know what they're talking about, have something positive and encouraging to say, spreading wisdom. I love to sit at the feet of people that are wise and can share information that can help benefit me and, you know, others. And it's with that, having said that, that I would like to introduce back to Health, Wealth, and Divine, a regular on the show. He's been with us for several years now, and we just feel very blessed to have, again, the opportunity to sit at the feet of somebody that knows what they're talking about and shares wisdom. In this particular segment, we're going to be talking about the wisdom in entrepreneurship. My special guest, if you don't know by now, is Joseph, that's Professor Joseph T. Geiger, author of the awesome book, Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top, 102 Business Principles. We have had the pleasure of having Professor Geiger with us for years, and I've read this book several times. My wife and I have actually read this book together several times, and each time we read it, we really enjoy it. And when we go even a month or so without reading, it's like we need to pick back up Professor Geiger's book again, because that's just how much we enjoy it. And we'll tell you how you can get a copy of it as well. It's actually a copy that you're going to need. If you're serious about being an entrepreneur, I mean serious about it. Sometimes people come into entrepreneurship and it's a fad. It's like, you know, hey, I think I'll start my own business. And then a couple of months later you talk to them, hey, how's that business going? Ah, well, you know, I'm into something else now. Well, if you're serious about becoming an entrepreneur, or if you're already one, staying one, then you definitely need this book, and you're not here by accident. You tuned in on purpose, so you know why you tuned in today, and you're going to get what you came for. Again, my special guest is Professor Joseph T. Geiger. In case you've never heard of Professor Geiger, by the end of this show, you won't forget him. Currently retired, Professor Geiger grew up on a Kansas farm and graduated from the School of Business at the University of Denver. And over his lifetime, he has started 10 businesses, two of which predated his college graduation. And after his second retirement, he taught entrepreneurship and small business management at J. Sargent Reynolds Community College, located in Richmond, Virginia, where he currently resides. Again, it's my pleasure to welcome back to the show Professor Geiger. Thank you for being my guest again today.
Thank you for asking me to come on.
It's my pleasure. Again, we're going to be talking about entrepreneurship, obviously something that you love. You've been doing it for over 50 years. Anytime you put that kind of time into something willingly, then you really must love what you do. And there has to be something about just being an entrepreneur. Maybe it's the freedom. Maybe it's the thought of taking an idea and bringing it to fruition, building something, and actually seeing it, nurturing it, putting your blood, sweat, and tears into it, and actually taking it from seed to fruit. There's got to be something about that.
Yeah, there is. That to me is what really drives you on. The business that I am the most proud of is not actually the most profitable one. And it may have been the hardest one, but it's what I did. I built a yacht company and designed and built high-speed offshore fishing yachts. And although they look like most any other yacht, there was a couple of distinctive features about them when you looked at it. But what really stood out is when you ran it, it just outran everything. It was a better seaboat. It was bigger. It was more stable. It just had a whole lot of features to it that you couldn't help but be intensely proud of. And in talking to lots and lots of other entrepreneurs, I hear that over and over. Very seldom, once a person is successful at doing it, do you hear them talk anything about the money that they made. I mean, that's just kind of almost a fringe benefit. But what they talk about is the business they built, their employees, how they're helping them, and what the business does. And you hear that just all the time. That's the big thing. And it really drives you on. At the age of 78 years young, I started my 11th business. I kept saying, I'll never do it again, but then there was an opportunity came by, and so I did. And so I'm now on number 11.
Wow. You know what, Professor, if we could talk about, before we really get into the book here, just teaching for a moment, because as we've discussed in previous shows, there once was a point when, you know, prior to the word entrepreneur becoming so fashionable, everybody's heard the term nowadays, but not too long ago, it was a word that people, if you were to say the word, people would have said, a what? You know, they wouldn't have known what you were talking about. And then to go from that to having seen the word evolve or to become so mainstream now, and then to now actually have taught it at the college level, they actually have a part of a college curriculum, entrepreneurship. That's how much, you know, it's grown. Could you talk about just the teaching aspect of it? Because when you started back, you know, so many years ago, over 50 years ago, again, the word was probably, you know, non-existent in some circles. But now, having watched it go from that and to the point now where it's a college curriculum, can you talk about just that, how that has evolved and, you know,
sure.
Just... Thank you.
Yeah. When I was in college, I'd never heard the word until many years after I graduated. There was no such course that I ever heard of in any college in the country. There were business colleges, but basically the business college that I went to and the others that were out there trained people to go to work for General Motors or for IBM or something like that. That was the end goal. And the idea of starting a new business was something that, it never crossed anybody's mind that would be the case. So that was all new. And there was, for a long time, there were people who said, well, you're born with it. And I don't think that's the case at all. I think maybe you have a drive and you go that way, but I don't think that you're born with it. There are some people, there are a few, that have a absolute gift for entrepreneurship, but the vast majority of us really don't. There are millions of businesses just here in the United States. And the vast majority hire less than five people, or five people and less. So they're over half are small, and the people do it in lieu of going to work for a big company. And I think many of them, if you said, well, if you went to the work for a big company, you'd make the same amount or more, and you'd work for 8 to 5, and you'd have nice vacations and benefits and all that. And I think the vast majority would say, well, that's wonderful, and God bless you if that's what you want to do, but that's really not for me. I'm doing what I like to do. And it gives you the freedom of building your own thing. And if it succeeds, you can pat yourself on the back and say, hey, I built that. And if it fails, you pat yourself on the back and said, well, I didn't do it quite right this time, but maybe I can do it better next time. At least I'll know one or two things not to do. When I wrote the book, a portion of it was to try to tell people what not to do as well as what to do. And the reason I wrote it was because in teaching, I read a bunch of textbooks, and what I found was that virtually all the textbooks were written by PhDs who had never, not only had they never started a business, the vast majority had never even worked for a business outside of academia, and yet they were telling people how to do it. That, to me, is kind of like a surgeon, somebody saying, well, I'm going to tell you how to be an orthopedic surgeon now. However, admittedly, I've never been in a hospital. I've never been in an operating room. I have read some books about it, and so I think I'm qualified to teach you how to fix people who have broken bones and be in the operating room. And I think anybody who heard that would find that kind of statement is absolutely absurd. But in entrepreneurship and in a lot of business settings, it's not absurd. It's what academia fully believes. And so that's why I wrote the book, and I teach because I enjoy it. I love to tell students things that I know that they will not hear in the books. And in many cases, I tell them things that the books tell you just the opposite. And I say, well, you believe the book if you want, but I can tell you, having done it for 50-plus years, that the guy who wrote the book has never done it, and that's why he says what he says.
You know, Professor, there's an inherent risk in striking out on your own as an entrepreneur. You know, some people embrace that. They'll take that and they love the challenge. It's like, you know, it fuels them, you know, it spurs them on, it gives them a rush, you know. And then there are others who the risk scares the heck out of them. It's like, man, I got a mortgage, you know, I got kids, I can't afford to, you know, go out here and fall flat on my face, you know. And they settle for the comfort of a paycheck every 2 weeks. It's predictable. They know exactly how much they're going to get. They can calculate their overtime, and they know if I work 40 hours or 50 or 60, I can expect to get this. And even though the average would probably feel as though they're underpaid, the average person, unless they're making, you know, a good six-figure salary, and even some of them might think they're underpaid, but the average person would say, you know, gosh, I could sure use a raise, you know. But because they can get by on the 40-hour week paycheck, you know, 80 hours every 2 weeks or whatever, and they can live, even though they may feel that they're living beneath what they should be living, they settle for that. Could you talk about briefly what it was that about you that just said, you know what, I love this challenge. I mean, you know, we've talked before, and you talked about how you love it so much that whereas the average person says, man, thank God it's Friday. You're like, thank God it's Monday. I just spent the last 2 days wishing I was at work, you know.
Yep.
So could you talk about that? Just the that if you're going to be an entrepreneur, yes.
I think you hit it right on the head. The thank God it's Friday is for working people, hourly and salary people who work for somebody else. And I think a lot of us entrepreneurs are just the opposite, and I certainly was. Thank God it's Monday so I can get back to doing what I like to do. And unless you have that calling and you've had that, it's almost like falling in love. It really is, where you meet somebody and you want to be with them all the time. And for a lot of entrepreneurs, they meet a opportunity and they start a business and they want to be at it all the time. And it's a very, very similar feeling. It doesn't have anything to do with paychecks. It doesn't have anything to do with the economic rewards. It has to do with the love of doing what you're doing. And I feel very sorry for people who say, thank God it's Friday, because the view I have is they spend 5 days a week doing what they really don't much like to do. They do it because they think they have to, and they kind of make peace with that, and so they go do it. But they don't really look forward to it, and what they look forward to is the 2 days a week that they're doing whatever it is that that they really like to do. And wouldn't it be nice that you could spend 5 days a week doing what you really, really wanted to do, and then for the other 2 days, you find something else that you like to do? family or whatever it is. But you're satisfied all the time instead of a small portion of the time. And it is the only thing I can tell people who haven't experienced it, it is absolutely like falling in love with your partner. And that's the feeling. It
wow.
may sound strange, but that is the feeling.
And if it's successful, and if the business is successful, the honeymoon continues, huh?
Yeah, it really does. It doesn't wear out. And frankly, even during the hard times, you think, well, I know I can do this. I just know I can do it. And so you spend time trying to do it. And I've been fortunate. The vast majority of mine have worked out. I've had some hard times, of course. Well, hell, everybody does when they start a business. But I wouldn't change a moment of it. I'd like to change some of the things, some of the hard times. But the overarching feeling about it, I have no interest in changing. And like I say, I thought that when I sold my last business and I was, well, let's see, about 65, I guess. Yeah, about 65, I thought, well, that'll be it. And I held off for a long time, and now I just recently started a new business, I enjoy it very, very much.
Fell in love again, huh, Professor?
Yep, kind of did.
It's in your blood.
And
man.
I still mm-hmm. teach, and people say, well, you're a professor now, and you're teaching, but the thing I'm proudest of is not being a professor. The thing I'm proudest of is starting and building a business. And there, in my case, there are 11 of them now, and I can look back and say, well, this one was a little better than that one, but hell, they were all great, and I enjoyed all of them.
And out of those experiences, I hold in my hand a book called Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top, 102 Business Principles. Throughout those 11 businesses, over 50 years' experience, Professor Geiger has given us an offering. And we've got 102 tips, okay, any of which is worth the cost of the book, could save you God knows how much money. Okay, so we're going to get into the book. Again, it's called Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top, 102 Business Principles. And if you're following us, you know that we're on Chapter 8 now. Okay, if you're just tuning in for the first time and hearing this show for the first time, go back and scroll through the archives. We started off with Chapter 1, and we're going through the book principle by principle. Okay, so I want to encourage everybody to get the book so that next month when Professor Geiger comes back on, you'll be up to speed. This is class, okay? So this is your textbook. So you'll be up to speed. So here we go. We're on Chapter 8, and the title of this chapter is Growing a Business. And the first principle we're going to talk about is the key to success is what customers want, not you want. Okay, as an entrepreneur, I'm sure there are times when you think that you know what the customer wants, but Professor Geiger is here to tell you differently. Professor, the key to success is what the customers want, not what you want.
Yeah, I think that's true, and that's kind of a fundamental portion of a business. All the principles, one of the reasons I wrote the book is because In textbooks and so on, the academia gives you these gauzy ivory tower sort of things, and you ask yourself after you've read a chapter or so, what is in here that I can actually put into action, that I can do? And the answer was actually nothing. It all sounded very good, but you couldn't actually do it. And so my principles, 102 of them, are things that you can actually do. So you start when you're getting ready to start the business to try to figure out in the opportunity that you have, what do customers want? And that needs to be a very foundation of your business. And it's something you can do. You find out what they want, and then you try to meet that want. All of us have wants and needs. And the reason I hit on wants now, a lot of people say, well, the things you really ought to do is what people really need, because then we all need it and you can sell to everybody. Well, that's fine for Walmart, but I'm never going to be a Walmart. I have no interest in being a Walmart. I want to do wants. And what people want is what they desire. What they need are things to keep you alive. You need water, you need housing, you need warmth in the winter, and you don't have to have it, but it's awful nice to have air conditioning and cool in the summer. Those are all needs. But wants are what people want. And in a class yesterday, I was teaching that, and there was a bunch of ladies in the class, and I said, now, you gals, there's a difference in wants. You need a bottle of water from time to time, but you probably you'd love to have a Louis Vuitton purse or a Coach purse. And the Louis Vuitton purses are $1,400. And I thought, and I said, well, that to me is absolutely idiocy, but I'm not the buyer. Mm-hmm. The buyer thinks it's not idiocy. The buyer thinks it's wonderful. The buyer thinks it's worthwhile. And there's lots and lots of ladies out there who not only want it, but they'll save money and they make good livings and they can buy a $700 purse or a $1,400 purse. And although that means nothing to me, it means a lot to them. Mm-hmm. So you find out what people want, and you focus in on that, on how that affects your niche, your opportunity that you're building, and you just absolutely drill down on it, and that is what you're going to do. You don't waver. You understand what they want. You learn more and more about what they want, and that is what you do, because that is actionable. You can do that. You can't do a lot of fuzzy things that colleges teach, but you can do this sort of thing. So that
foundation. Let me ask you this. How about when it comes to, I don't want to use the word morals or ethics, but you know, I remember a few years back, there was a big controversy over Michael Jordan's shoes or I guess the cost, the amount of the shoes that he was, that they were selling. I guess Nike was putting them out, and they were costing an exorbitant amount of money. And, I mean, people were actually killing each other to get these shoes, you know what I mean? Somebody would rob somebody out of their shoes or – if not that example, you know, let's say, for example, you're selling somebody something that they want. It's clear that they need, something else. And you might go home shaking your head, right? You might just go home scratching your head. You know, it's like, dang, I just sold somebody, a Louis Vuitton. You know, they came in here and bought a Louis Vuitton bag, you know what I mean? But they had their child with them, and the child looked like they needed shoes, you know what I mean? So at what point does an entrepreneur, or even just say, for example, yourself, maybe morals and maybe values is a better word, because there are some people that would say, well, you know, I'm not going to sell that to them. I'm not even going to carry that. You know, even though I know people want it, I'm not going to carry it because I'm not going to contribute to, you know, whatever. Like you might have a store owner that says, hey, I'm not going to sell cigarettes and wine. You know what I mean? Because I don't want to contribute to, even though people want it, you know, they'll come in here and buy it all day long, but I'm not going to contribute to, the ill health or, people getting robbed for shoes or, somebody clearly could find better use for $1,400 than a purse, you know. So, I mean, is there a line, I think, that you ever had to draw in your businesses? I mean, I know you sold airplanes, so it's totally different, but ever had any come face-to-face with yourself in terms of, you know, should I actually sell this? Is this in the best interest of the customer, or do I just want to make a buck?
Well, I think that when you say I just want to make a buck, that's not the way I would view it. First of all, if you're selling women's accessories in a depressed area, you probably aren't going to handle those very high end because, frankly, they don't have the funds to do it. But I think it's a big mistake for anybody to say, because I believe something, that everybody should believe that. And I think that's a bit of a mistake. Now, if you have a women's accessory store on in Hollywood and or in Fifth Avenue, New York, the vast majority of people who walk through the door are going to say, "You mean that purse is only $750?" And
right,
although
right.
I would find that is just silly to have that view, that's their view, and it's probably because they view the value of a dollar very differently than I do. And just because they view it differently than I do does not necessarily mean that they're right and I'm wrong, or vice versa. Mm-hmm. I could remember in my life when I thought, boy, if I could ever make $1,000 a month, I would own the world. And when I made many times that, I look back on it and say, you know, your views of things have changed. I remember when I was selling yachts one time, I had a guy who had bought a yacht, which today would be $700,000-$800,000. At that time, it was a great deal less than that, but nevertheless, it was still a lot of money. And he brought a fellow in who had never had a yacht. And he said, "Joe, do you have anything used?" And because Jerry here would kind of want to get into it. And we had a boat that was $17,000 today. It would probably be $60,000 to $80,000, the same boat. And so we went down and looked at it. And I remember very well the man said to my customer, what happened if I don't like it?" And he said, "Well, hell, it's only $17,000. For God's sakes, we can just go out offshore and sink the damn thing if you don't like it, and I'll bring you back." I was just dumbfounded because at that time, $17,000 was about what I made in a year. And here these two guys were talking about it as being nothing. And I thought, you know, Joseph, maybe you should learn something from this. And because $17,000 is an awful lot of money, and at that time a $100,000 yacht was something that was just, for me, beyond belief, it wasn't to them. And they had very substantial incomes. And I thought to myself, wouldn't it be nice if I had that kind of income? Maybe I ought to work for it. And perhaps someday I could. So the... I think if I had a women's accessory store in an area where the average person there was making $30,000-$40,000 or say $60,000 at the upper end, I probably would not stock Louis Vuitton purses. I'm not so sure I would stock Michael Jordan shoes, but the reason I wouldn't is because I would think to myself, the number I would sell would not make it worthwhile to do that. But if I had a shop on Rodeo Drive in Hollywood, then stocking Louis Vuitton purses would make eminent sense, because there the customer could spend $1,400 and he or she would not feel that that's very much at all.
You know, that reminds me of one of your other rules. All decisions are data driven.
Yeah, they really are. And when you're building a business, it doesn't make any difference whether you're building aircraft carriers for the U.S. government or you're mowing lawns for your next door neighbor. if you're not satisfying your customer and what your customer wants, doesn't make any difference what you want, what you think is important, but it does make a difference what your customer thinks. And if you're not satisfying that need, that want, your customer will go find somebody who will satisfy their need or want. So if you're going to be successful, you better do it. And you better understand how they think. Doesn't make any difference how you think. You may think that that used boat at $17,000 was something that, boy, you'd really like to have, and you'd really take care of it, and because it's a lot of money. But you got to understand there are people out there where it's not a lot of money. So, and I make no value judgments on that. I must say, again, if I was in a area where people had modest means, I wouldn't stock that kind of stuff. Whether a few wanted it or not, I think the few who wanted it would go where they could get it. I would stock what the vast majority of people who were the customers wanted, and I'd know what they wanted, and I'd try to get the very, very best I could of whatever that was. And I'm not entirely sure that a $1,400 Louis Vuitton purse is all that much better a purse than a $500 purse or a $50 purse. They all do the same thing. My wife would say you're out of your mind at $50 because I buy them for 10 or 12 on sale, and then I modify them the way I like. And so, again, it's what people, your customer wants. And just get your darn values out of that. Try to satisfy your customer. And if you do that, on balance, you'll do okay.
All right. Everybody, I see the lines are lighting up here. If you have a question, all you have to do is just press 1, and then I can bring you on if you'd like to make a comment. Again, we're going to tell you how you can get this book. It's an awesome book. We're going to tell you how you can get it. Matter of fact, let's do that now, Professor. We're halfway through. So if we can just take a moment before we go to the next principle and tell people how. Now, that was just one principle. Okay, we've only covered one principle in this show, okay? And, I mean, you can tell the wisdom that's exuding from Professor Geiger after having over 50 years' experience as an entrepreneur. Professor, for people who are interested in getting the book, and again, this is the textbook now, this is class, so, you know, next class is going to be this time next month. You should have the book by then and have read up to at least Chapter 8. I know by then you won't stop at Chapter 8. You'll keep reading like I did. But, Professor, how can they get your book?
Well, there's two ways. You can go to Amazon. It's sold there. And I sell it at my website, theroadtothetop.com. And the only difference, Amazon and I both charge the same. We charge the same for shipping. The only difference is that I sign the ones that I send out. But other than that, they're the same. And give me a call or order one, and love to have you order it for me, and I'll sign it for you and send it right to you, probably the same day that you send it in. So they go right out.
The holidays are coming up, everybody. I mean, before you know it, Christmas is going to be here, and, you know, birthdays are happening all the time. This would be a perfect gift for somebody that you know has, you know, even talked about starting their own business. There are a lot of people that talk about it and talk about it and talk about it, but, you know, you need a map. You need a road map. You need somebody to guide you. And what better person to guide you than somebody who's been doing it for over 50 years, longer than many people that are listening to this show have even been on the planet. So definitely take advantage of this opportunity to share this wisdom with people that you know, even if it's not for you, even if it's you're like, hey, you know, entrepreneurship isn't for me, but I do have a nephew, or I do have a son, or I do have a brother or somebody that I know that is either considered starting their own business or they are already in business. You can't learn, you can never know too much. So even if somebody's already in business, this book would be perfect for them, and they would definitely appreciate the fact that you thought about them enough and their business enough to get the book for them. Okay, moving right along, let's move on to the next principle. The next principle is profitability is the goal, not growth. Professor?
Yeah, this is a cautionary tale. Once, and I am guilty of this over and over again. I have to keep hauling myself back and say, hey, hold, slow down here. Once you build a business and once you get it up and running, you immediately say, how can I make it grow? And you start doing things to make it get bigger and bigger, sell more or whatever it is, build more, sell more. But you should remember that the goal here is not selling more. The goal is being profitable. There are lots and lots of businesses that have gone out of business, have gone bankrupt, because they grew themselves into bankruptcy. They did not follow this. It's a simple test that you can put to anything that you're going to do. Can I make this profitable in a fairly short period of time? And there's people who are very, very experienced who allow themselves to forget this. One that comes to mind is Bill Lear, who made the Learjet, who designed it. It was the first small jet ever built for non-military, non-governmental purposes. It was built for business people. And he built it, and it was an immediate raving success. And because Mr. Lear ran in circles where he knew people and knew them well who were very, very wealthy and who ran big companies. And his Learjet, what happened is they were telling him almost immediately that, hey, this Learjet is fine, but I have a company that hires 80,000 people. We have plants all over the country and all over the world. I need something a great deal bigger than the Learjet. And he, originally four people and two pilots in it, or six and two pilots, and they wanted something that would handle 20 or more. And there wasn't anything. And Learjet ran himself into bankruptcy trying to develop it. And he got fairly well along, and he just ate up all the money that the small airplane was making, and it was making a lot of money. And instead of going one little step at a time, he said, I'm going to build this much bigger airplane, and it bankrupted him. And Mr. Lear had many very successful businesses, but he fell in love with the idea of growing and not being profitable. Now, had he been able to had the money to put it into production, it probably would have been profitable. But that airplane, an airplane of that size, costs millions and millions of dollars to certify and to build a prototype, to certify it and to build the production tooling. He just didn't have that kind of money. He was pretty wealthy, but he was nowhere near that wealthy. Today, an airplane like that would probably cost the better part of $1 billion. By the time you built the first one, you got it certified, you built the tooling, and you started to produce them. And unless you have that kind of real serious money, it's going to be a tough road. And he was in the business, but I guess he felt so much in love, he knew that it would sell, and it would. It did, as a matter of fact. He sold the company elsewhere. They spun off that new airplane, and it is now in production. It's been in production for many years, and it's highly successful. It can be done, but he couldn't do it. He just didn't have that kind of funds to do it. And he fell in love. He forgot that the goal needs to be profit, and within the time period that you have.
You know what's interesting is, you know, just the fact that something has to drive us. You know, as you mentioned concerning Mr. Lear, that he was wealthy. You know, he had money. The Learjet was making a profit, a good profit. But that wasn't enough. I mean, somebody said they needed something else. I mean, so at this point in his life, money obviously wasn't an issue. It became an issue when he, you know, was trying to build the new thing. But as far as up until that, it sounds like he could have retired and lived comfortably and not had to work another day.
he could. And he had lots of inventions that most people don't know about. The 8-track stereo, which nowadays it hadn't been out there for a long time, but he invented it. And the reason I know Mr. Lear is because I had the vending machine contract. I was in the vending business at the time, and I had the vending machine contract at Learjet. And I was wandering around there, and the guy who managed my contract with Lear, we were going around setting up kiosks for the vending machine for their employees, and he introduced me to Mr. Lear, and Mr. Lear said, are you interested in airplanes, young man? And I had just gotten my pilot's license. So he spent an hour with me sitting in his new airplane, showing it to me. He was so proud of it, and he should have been. And so I got to know him, and when we got through, he got through with the airplane. He said, hey, I got something else to show you. You're a young guy. You like music. What do you think of this? How would you like to be able to have your own music instead of having to listen to the radio? And at that time, there was if you had a car, you had a radio in the car. And as a matter of fact, it was Bill Lear who figured out how to make a radio work in a car. He had the original patents. So he took me over to his car to show me this 8-track stereo. His car was a Cadillac station wagon. I'd never seen one before. And I mentioned it to him, and he said, well, it's the only one there is. He knew the people who ran Cadillac, and so he said, I want a station wagon. I have a big family, and I want a station wagon. He said, well, we don't make a station wagon. He said, make it. And they said, it'd be costly. It costs a lot of money. And Bill Lear said, I don't give a damn what it costs. I said, I want one. I'll pay for it, whatever it costs. So when he said he could live comfortably, he surely could.
And still got up and was presented with a challenge that, okay, I need a plane that can hold X amount of people. Can you build it? And he went about, you know, about building it.
Yeah.
And I think that when you get to a certain point, you know, that's your life. I mean, you know, you run in those circles where money's not a problem. You know, you're motivated by other things, and it's not money because, I mean, you got enough that you can just live off of for the rest of your life, you and your kids. So it's something else that's motivating you at that point. So
that's true.
That must have been for you to be able to hobnob with Mr. Lear. That must have been something for you as a young man.
Oh, it was. It was a thrill because this guy, I mean, he was a brilliant man. When he saw a problem, he solved it right then. He figured out a way to do it. And he'd come in the factory early in the morning, and he'd leave snowflakes around. They called them snowflakes. And he had Post-its had just come out. And he would walk around and in the engineering area and other areas, and he'd see something, and he'd write off a little note and stick it to wherever it was, on their chair, on their desk, or their work table. And he knew everybody in the factory by name. And there was, at that time, there was 500-600 in the factory. He knew them all by name. You know, I hear people say when they talk about Donald Trump, well, he doesn't know his workers at all. I don't know whether he does or not. But if he had the same kind of personality that Bill Lear did, he probably does know hundreds of them. And by their name, he knew about their children. He was interested in his people, And that's the reason that they would work extra hours for him, and they wouldn't charge. You know, at most factories, well, I also had Coleman Company, and the Coleman people were really dedicated, but not like the Learjet people were. And come 4:45, you'd see people starting to put up their tools and cleaning them up. That didn't happen at Learjet. You'd see people come 5 o'clock and 5:30, and they'd still be there and hard at it, and you'd say, hey, pal, you know, quitting time was 5 o'clock, half an hour ago. He said, yeah, but I got to get this done for Mr. Lear.
Right. That's dedication. That's dedication.
Yeah, it is.
It's like
it is.
Most people are looking at the clock. They're counting down at 4 o'clock. They're looking at the clock like one more hour to go.
Yeah, but so. That's not the way they saw it there. They thought, I've got a job to do, and I'm going to do it. And if I have to stay late to do it, fine. And I saw people who would go clock out there and then go back to work.
Hmm.
And that was during time they had punch cards that if you were an hourly worker, you punched in the morning and you punched out at night. And I saw people go over, punch out, and walk back to their – and these are not suits, you know. These are working men, working with their hands on lathes or putting things together. That kind of person. And they would clock out from there and then go back to work. So they were on their time. They weren't charging for it.
And you know what? That's the purpose of me coming on and sharing Professor Geiger with you and this book, Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top. Because if you're an entrepreneur, then you want that kind of dedication. You want that type of loyalty. You know, you want that type of service from the people that you have hired and that are working for you. You want that. And so if you follow the principles in this book, then you can have a business that can far outseed, even your, did I say outseed, far succeed, far, I'm trying to put two words together here, your own expectations, exceed your own expectations. So definitely, we're going to tell you again at the end of the show how you can get the book. Professor, maybe I don't know if we have enough time to squeeze in one more principle. I'll leave it up to you. We can talk about this next principle, and that is, if your cash flow forecast finds a financial problem, you have found a business problem. Or we can talk about the new project, your new book that you got coming out, and or that's actually out now, and the new series that we're going to be doing. We're going to be doing a show or several shows on Professor Geiger's new book, because I know that when we're talking about the financial, the cash flow, that can get somewhat in depth. And
yeah, we're going to get down in some weeds here before we're through, and if we just try to brush through it, people will come out and not really understand what this is all about. The other might make more sense because we're down to 10, 11 minutes here. I've done a book, and the title of the book is Finding a Career for Life. It is written for juniors and seniors in high school, freshmen and sophomore in college, that age group. Not just, you don't have to be in college to make it make sense. But it's, and the reason I did it is because I talked to so many younger people who were coming into my class, and they'd say, I got a degree in something or other, and I was all hopped up about it. Unfortunately, I have a bunch of debt for it, but I thought I could go out, and they told me I could go out and get a good job, and I couldn't. And I thought, you know, quite frankly, I could have, if you had talked to me before, I could have told you you couldn't. But I didn't know why I could tell. I didn't really have the facts. So I spent 6 months or more just really researching hard to find out some real facts, and I think I succeeded. So what the book does, it tries to guide young people into careers that will be, first of all, satisfying. You know, when we first started the program this evening, you talked a good deal about what motivated me and how it was that I would say, thank God it's Monday. And so the book is written from that perspective. You first need to love to do whatever you're doing. If you don't like doing it, two things are going to happen. First are, you're not going to do a particularly good job because you don't really like it. And eventually you're going to say, I don't care how much they're paying me to do this. I don't like it. I'm going to go find something I like. So maybe you ought to start from that to begin with. So you need to, I think, find something you like to do. But that doesn't necessarily mean whatever it is, you aren't going to get paid well for it. So, for example, if you happen to like pets a lot, maybe you ought to think about being a veterinarian. As it turns out, veterinarians are the third most secure job there is out there. There is less than let's see, it's 0.3% unemployment among veterinarians. And needless to say, they make very good livings. So if that's something you'd like to do, well, you could learn to be a vet. And it doesn't make any difference whether you want to live in New York City or Newton, Kansas. When you get there, there's going to be a job for you there. And you can start your own clinic if you want, but if you don't, you can work for somebody and there'll be a job. And then if you want to move to some other place, to California or Minnesota or wherever the heck it is, there'll be a job. If you're a veterinarian, you will have a job. If you decide somebody talks you into you want to get a degree in psychology, the one thing I can tell you almost for sure, you will not find a job in psychology until you have a PhD. So a bachelor's degree and a master's degree in psychology does not lead to a job that has anything to do with psychology. There's lots of other things. So maybe your heart is set on that. Well, why is it set on psychology? Is it because you like people and you want to do things for people? Well, then perhaps you should look at being a nurse. And if you think, well, a nurse is just, I don't want to do that. How about a nurse practitioner or a nurse anesthesiologist? And those two it doesn't make any difference where you want to go. You're going to find a job and you're going to get extremely well paid if you're in any of those. So my view is if what you want to be is get a degree in psychology, well, God bless you, go do it. But do it with knowledge that when you get through, you're going to have a hard time finding a job that pays almost anything. And that is the perspective that the book is written from. So you can decide what you want to be, what fires your rocket, find something that you can do, and maybe you can find something that you can support your family on. And then there's other things in the book that you won't find any other place. Where should you go? There are some cities that if you go there, the job prospects are terrific. And there's other cities that they're not. We're in Richmond, Virginia. And of the 150 cities that I found some research on, Richmond is number 50. So it's certainly not at the bottom, but it's also not at the top. And I also built some worksheets in there. So if you want to try to choose a college, there's a worksheet that you can put numbers on. And when you get through, it will become fairly clear of the five choices that you have. You're not sure which college of these five you want. It will help make it very clear if you want to pick a city to go to, and so you pick five or so different cities, it will make it very clear where, from a purely financial job prospect and also an enjoyment prospect, where you go. It has the book has one other thing for the jobs, for almost any career path. I found a way to discern what people who are doing it think of it. And there were some real surprises. An example, I thought that computer nerds would really, really like to be in the computer business. And what I found was that people who were in the computer business didn't like it all that much. Don't ask me why. I mean, I'm not here to answer the question why. I'm just here to tell you what the facts are. And that one was a big, big surprise.
That is a surprise. I
just fell over in a dead faint. If you're kind of outdoorsy and you're interested a little in science, and you then get a degree in petroleum engineering, you will make more than any PhD out there on average. A bachelor's degree in the petroleum engineering pays more than any master's or any PhD in anything, with the exception of a master's in petroleum engineering, and then the difference is about 2%. And I was surprised at that. Why would you go an extra 2 years and get all of that extra money invested in your career when, if you just have a bachelor's, mid-career you can expect essentially $160,000 a year, and or $170,000 a year rather, and as a master's degree you can expect $174,000. I mean, if I knew that up front, there's no way I would go get a master's unless there was something else that I don't know. And if you get a PhD, it doesn't pay as much as either the master's or the bachelor's in petroleum engineering. Don't ask me why. Can't answer that question. I can just tell you what the facts are.
This is
so there's all. Yeah, there's. It is. It's absolutely fascinating. And when people tell you that in order to get a good job, you have to have a college education, that is patently not true. Let's say that you'd like to be in a profession where the average makes over $150,000 a year. Be an airline pilot. Doesn't require a college education. Requires knowing how to fly an airplane. There's a whole bunch of others. When I looked into what are the most secure jobs, there were of the, I think, 21 that I listed, there's five of them that do not require a college education, and yet they pay very, very well. So it's a fascinating study.
What's interesting about this is that you have two books here, Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top, 102 Business Principles, and your last book is about how helping people to find the right job. I mean, that is amazing. That's amazing to me. I mean, because here you've been an entrepreneur for over 50 years, a successful entrepreneur, teach and have taught entrepreneurship on a college level. And now your new project is helping people to find the right business to get into, you know.
The right career, and the careers don't necessarily have anything to do with entrepreneurship.
Absolutely.
I'll leave you with one last thing, and we'll be about out of time, and that is in the period of 2000 to 2011, there were 10,700,000 jobs, new jobs created during that period. There was 29 million new people in America, but there was 10,000, 10,700,000 jobs created. The government in job growth added to that 1,236,000. The private sector minus 1,235,000. The net was that there was 105,000 new salary and wage jobs created. The balance were all.
You mean 105 million? Don't you?
There was 105,000 net new jobs created for salary and wage earners. Entrepreneurs added 10,700,000. 99% of all the new jobs, according to the IRS, came from entrepreneurs.
Wow. Well, if you're in that number, if you're in that number of one of those entrepreneurs, and you want to stay in that number, because again, most small businesses fail within the first year, and if you don't want to be in that unfortunate number, but you want to be in the number of those successful entrepreneurs, I encourage you to get the book, Entrepreneurial Success: The Road to the Top, 102 Business Principles by Professor Joseph T. Geiger. You can get that by going to theroadtothetop.com. You can get it from Amazon, or you can get it from Professor Geiger personally, and he'll sign it for you, okay? And make sure that you tune in next month, and I'm actually going to see if we can I'll be getting with you, Professor, to see if we can get do this show earlier, because I hate to have the people wait another month for this information. This is so good. We're going to be talking about the cash flow forecast. I mean, you cannot expect to have a successful business if you're not familiar with the cash flow forecast, what it does, and not just be familiar with it, but utilize it. So we'll be talking about that the next time we have Professor Geiger on. Professor, any parting words for our listeners today?
No, not really. Hope you buy the book, and you'll find that I can't guarantee you success, but I can probably tell you that if you fail, it won't be in the first year if you follow the principles in the book.
And the reason he can't guarantee you success is because it's on you. You know, he can't foresee in a crystal ball whether you're going to do the principles in the book. You know, because you just increase your odds of being successful by following the principles in the book from somebody who's been doing it for over 50 years successfully. Okay, so definitely for all of the entrepreneurs, you need this book. For all of the people who know and love entrepreneurs, definitely get the book for them. Professor Geiger, always a pleasure speaking with you. I'll be getting with you soon to see can we move up the next interview, because I don't want to keep the listeners waiting another month, if that's okay.
You bet. Sure will.
All right. Talk to you soon. Everybody, that is Professor Joseph T. Geiger, author of the fabulous book, Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top. You know there's a road to the top. You just don't wake up on top. Okay, not as an entrepreneur, there's a road to get there. And if you're on that road, you need somebody that's been through hurdles and, you know, done the things that you're going to have to do. It makes it so much easier when you have somebody that's saying, hey, look out for that landmine right there. You're climbing this mountain. There's a landmine over there. Hey, look, I've been there. You don't want to go that route. You want to do this, you know. So if you're an entrepreneur, you know, and you're just starting out, it can seem daunting. You know, the road to the top can just seem like just, oh, my God, it just seems so overwhelming. But if you take your time and you take things one step at a time and you do things the right way, there are no shortcuts, okay? If you're going to get to the top and you're going to get there the right way, then follow the advice from someone that's been there. I'm going to be getting with Professor Geiger to see if we can get him back on before next month so that we can really continue this conversation, because I'm enjoying it and I know that you are too. Thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in. Again, theroadtothetop.com. That's how you can get the book. If you're an entrepreneur, you need it, and if you're an entrepreneur, you should want it, okay? We talked about wants versus needs and give the customers what they want. Well, you tuned in, so you wanted this information, so I think it's soon that you want the book, too. So my name is Juwanza. Thank you so much for your time, everybody. Until the next time, everybody, stay safe. Enjoy the rest of your evening.